Hello and welcome to the official podcast of Palate Exposure, featuring Ilona Thompson, a podcast for those seeking the ultimate in wine, food, and travel. Each week, she interviews winemakers, chefs, celebrities, and a variety of guests that shape the way we enjoy life.
And there's daily pressure sacrifice that or compromise that.
Exactly.
It's hard. It takes a lot of diligence to stay focused. And, you know, the cornerstone of all of that is what we talked about earlier, that 1968 legislation is the underpinnings of all of that. But there's sort of a constant shift of political interests and so forth. Mm-hmm. And so it's interesting to see how that's all evolving, but I'm one of the luckiest guys in the world to have been party to the evolution of that.
Speaking of, we left you at Mondavi tasting 82 Margaux.
Yep.
Have you tasted it since?
I have not had it in a long time. I have had it since then, but I probably haven't had it in 5+ years, maybe 10 years. I'm sure it's still amazing. Seminal vintage.
But what a story, tasting your first 82 Bordeaux with none other than Mondavi. Yep, sure. Sounds perfectly normal.
It's like jamming with Jimi Hendrix, you know?
Exactly. That's exactly right. I believe that you're the luckiest guy, you know? I'm starting to feel that way, too. I'm going to rub you for good luck. Wow. So there you were, apprenticing at Mondavi, and where did your journey take you next?
So I think apprenticing is gracious. I was there really to pay rent, and my true passion at that time was not wine. It was there that the seeds really started to get planted.
Got it.
But my passion was music at that time. Mm-hmm. And I graduated Salina High in 1982, and I was chewing my arms off to get the hell out of here. I thought this was the slowest, most backward place you could possibly imagine. I wanted to be in an urban environment. I wanted to be playing music, loud rock and roll, playing in the club scene and doing that, all that stuff. So after I graduated, I took a year off and traveled in Europe a bit, and then I moved to Boston, and I went to school in Boston and played some music in Boston. And at that time, just like literally the month before I left for school, the band that I had been playing in all through high school started to kind of break a little bit in the Bay Area, which was really, really interesting. Like all of a sudden, like now I have to leave that and go off to Boston to go to school. And so I did, and I was in Boston for basically a semester, and I just, the whole San Francisco music scene was exploding, and I was like, no, I need to get back there. That's what I need to do. And I moved back to San Francisco and really put my head down and started playing very seriously in the club scene and the music scene in the city, and formed a band called Noonday Underground, which was this sort of alternative power pop band, kind of modeled after The Who and The Kinks and The Jam and a little bit of Clash influences. And the early iterations was really a pure mod band. And then it sort of morphed into other things over time. But chased that dream hard for 10 years. And Mondavi was kind of in that period where I was sort of toggling back and forth between Napa Valley and San Francisco, and I was spending part-time working, part-time going to school, part-time playing music at night and chasing the dream.
So guitar, was she instrumental?
Yeah, I played guitar and sang and was the principal songwriter for this band, and it was 10 of some of the best years of my life. I mean, it was really magical. It was really fun. I mean, there's right now, I get an enormous thrill out of cracking one of our bottles of wine and seeing it light people up. I mean, that to me is an incredibly thrilling thing, and I get to do that on a very regular basis. The equivalent of that would be the very first time that I heard one of my songs on the radio. That was just one of these hair standing up on the back of your neck moments. It was just an incredible thing. I was We were driving in the streets of San Francisco and we were listening to one of the radio stations, and we had dropped some demo tapes off, and all of a sudden they play it. Like, and I'm like, oh my God, we're on the radio. That's amazing. And that snowballed a little bit into a nice little local following. So we're playing the local club scene, and we had a really good following, and we were kind of tracking. We had really good management. And the scene that we were playing in spawned a bunch of really big bands.
Really?
And we were, there was, you know, sort of this funneling up process that you do, and you spend a bunch of years at it, and you start, you know, kind of climbing up the ladder, and you get to a certain level, and now you're playing in a group of bands that are, you know, all radio ready. Any one of them could have been the next thing. And, you know, we were in that band. And so, Counting Crows came out of that scene, and Chris Isaak came out of that scene, and later Green Day would come out of that scene. Third Eye Blind came out of that scene.
Wow.
Train came out of that scene. Band called Jellyfish, that should have been one of the biggest bands ever, had two amazing albums, but for whatever reason didn't track in a big way. Came out of that scene. Wire Train came out of that scene. Jeff Trott, who played in Wire Train, has been Sheryl Crow's guitarist for years. And there are a whole bunch of others. The Call, Romeo Void, the earlier sort of punk side of that scene was Dead Kennedys and so forth. So it was this incredible alternative hodgepodge mixing cultural thing that San Francisco, and music was a big part of San Francisco's DNA, going back into the, you know, the into the 60s and the Fillmore and all of the bands that sort of hubbed out of the Haight-Ashbury and so forth. Our scene was different than that, but it had the import of it. I mean, the San Francisco music scene was a really, really important music scene.
So I kind of sheepishly almost glossed over in the introduction, oh, there's some music in your background, but I knew how deep it went, and I'm really excited to hear all the details, because the songwriting piece in particular, that is not necessarily something that gets discussed enough. Mm-hmm. In the music business, and
yeah.
It's such a huge element of it, and the fact that you wrote your own material.
Mm-hmm.
How did that even come about? How did you study for it? Is it something that was really organic?
I took my share of music classes and so forth, but I didn't have a studied musical background. I'm mostly self-taught. You know what's really interesting, and I never thought about it until this exact moment, how the songwriting element came about. But there is a connection back to wine. And I remember when I was in high school, I was always really, really into music. I had older brothers and sisters that grew up. My oldest brother's 14 years older than I am, so they grew up cutting their teeth on all of the British Invasion and Americana music that was happening in the mid to late 60s and early 70s. So the Kinks and the Who and the Stones and Hendrix and Zeppelin and all that kind of stuff was schooled on that by my older brothers and sister. So music was always like really front and center for me. And then when I was in high school, I remember having this conversation with John Davies, who is the middle son of the Three Davies Boys at Schramsburg.
Mm-hmm.
And he was very influential in my life at that time, and he was really into music. And at one point he said to me, Jeff, who's the most important guy in the band? And I thought, and I was like, the lead singer. And he goes, nope. I'm like, come on, lead singer. It's got to be the lead singer. It's like, nope, that's not the most important guy in the band. Okay, the lead guitar player. Nope. Not the lead guitar. Well, if it's not the singer, it's not the lead guitar player. I know it's not the drummer. I know it's not the bass player. There are a lot of drummers and bass players who are going to be really pissed off at me. And subsequently, I learned how friggin' important they are. But I'm like, well, if it's not the guitar player, and it's not the bass player, and it's not the drummer, and it's not the singer, who the hell is it? He said, it's the writer. And it was a game changer for me. It was a game changer.
That was a wise comment, because writing, people don't realize.
Think about that. That was like a 16 or 17 year old kid who came up with that idea. And I'm clueless. I'm like, oh, it's gotta be the guitar player or the singer, for Christ's sake. Nope, the writer.
But writing is...
That changed a lot for me. And I have referenced that story before. I didn't really think about it so much in the context of, you know, sort of wine and so forth. But it was a game changer for me. And it was like, well, so the writer's the creator. And the writer's responsible for the creative spark and energy and direction and so forth. And so then so that became important to me, and then aesthetics started to become important to me as well. So how not only what you know, this process of creating something and pulling it out of thin air, but then there's like what's the window dressing? What does it look like? What does it sound like? What does it taste like? What is it, you know? These are all important elements that would inform my music side and how I was approaching music. So not only was I fascinated by writing music and writing lyrics, but what was the tone of the band? Like what was the reason for being? Like what were we trying to accomplish with our lyrics? What was the mood we were trying to set? How did we want our live shows to come across? What did we dress? What did we look like? What was the lighting all about? What was the staging backdrop all about? What kind of equipment were we using? All of those elements, to me, wound into this greater aesthetic, which is a rock band. And I've been asked many times, like, how did you come about your entrepreneurial insights and so forth? And the answer really is, my dad set the spark from a business standpoint, but the understanding of aesthetics was all framed by music and my experience trying to launch a rock band.
So when I run into Jeff at wine events in Napa Valley, he's always the best dressed guy in the room. Truth. And now I see that your aesthetic point of view, I mean, it just seeps through everything. Why not fashion? But your dad's influence and the fact that you ask yourself the right questions, because I think fundamentally that's what it takes. I mean, everything you described, people studying business schools, it comes up in conversations, but the stickability is not quite as formidable as in your case. It seems that those seminal conversations that you were having, like with Davis and Davies and others, had that imprint on what you did. You acted on it. You didn't just absorb the information, but you actually implemented it somehow.
My dad was a doer, you know, and so I probably got that wiring somehow from him. He was also very strategic. So he was a B-17 squadron commander in World War II. Heavy stuff. I mean, we can't even begin to grapple with what that psychology must be like to jump in a plane with 9 other guys and go get shot at. And it's really intense. And I remember him telling me one time, he said, Jeff, you know, one of the fundamental things we learned in flight school was, what is your bailout zone?
What is your bailout zone?
So how are you going, if something bad goes down, where are you going to bail out to? How are you going to crash land? How are you going to survive when things don't go as planned? And you have to be thinking about that in live time always. So when I'm in the cockpit flying a B-17 with, you know, 13 other planes or whatever is in the squadron, what happens when the shit hits the fan and things don't go as planned? And so we're constantly trained to find contingencies, bailout contingencies. What happens if you lose your right two engines and you can't make it back to base? How are you going to parachute? Are you going to crash land? Are you going to find a place to, you know, get that plane down and get your crew safe? what are you going to do with all of the sensitive material and Norton bombsight, all of the things that they were, you know, these are war secrets and so forth that they didn't want the enemy to have. So they had to think through all of these contingencies, and they were constantly contingency planning in live time. And that has serviced me well relative to being a risk taker. So there are all kinds of risk takers out there. I like to calculate my risks. And the only way you can calculate your risks is to be strategic in the way you think. And my dad taught me how to do that. Or at least he taught me the importance of doing it.
That's an extraordinary education that you had right in front of you on a daily basis, what you learned by osmosis as well as through verbal communication.
Yeah. A lot of osmosis.
But the fact that your dad was a war hero, my God, I mean, I think the wussiest part of subsequent generations is the fact that we never had to think about the worst case scenario. And especially like in the current climate, it seems like we think more about what we're entitled to than what is it that we're going to do if, like you said, it all falls apart.
It's a fundamental shift, and it's really, really dangerous. And I, you know, again, I don't want to get too deep into politics and so forth, but I think that we have some really, really important decisions to make as a culture that are being decided by expediency, entitlement, and the desire to hold power, rather than what are the fundamental strategic things that make us stronger as a culture. And there's tremendous erosion right now. Leadership matters.
Yes, it does.
It matters a lot. And, you know, I don't care whether you're Republican or Democrat or whatever, but leadership matters, and the core values of what makes America great are being eroded. And that's troubling to me, really troubling. And my dad, who was a staunch conservative, would be going bananas right now. Mm-hmm. Absolutely bananas at the failure of leadership to protect the fundamental things that make our country work beautifully.
Well, we're much like Napa Valley, one of a kind. And we need to be protected as such. And we're doing a really lousy job protecting ourselves from ourselves.
That's very true. That's very true. Now, this may pass, and it may, you know, it may result in an awakening, and you see threads and signs of that, of people on both sides of the aisle saying, well, wait a minute, you know, are we sacrificing our long-term security for short-term power?
Absolutely, every day. Well, I'm glad we're in the wine country, because those kinds of sentiments need a lot of wine. So, apropos, you're in San Francisco now, going back to the work in Napa Valley, play in San Francisco. By play, I mean not play, but actually work as well. But play music and write songs. So what's happening at this time in your life?
Yeah, so I'm chasing the dream, mm-hmm. and it's hard.
Yeah.
And it's not a straight line. Nothing in that way was a straight line. Probably not for any musician. The old saying, you know, an overnight success is 10 years in the making. It's very true. You know, we see the breaking point of these bands that, you know, all of a sudden explode, but we don't see the 10, 15 years of schlogging that it took to get there and make that happen. So I was on the schlog side. And I was getting a little bit older, and so I'm in my late 20s. I think I was 26 at the time, and my dad got terminally ill.
I'm so sorry.
And with cancer, and that was really, really hard for me, because I had a really good relationship with my dad, and I loved him very dearly, and had just, as you can imagine, learned so much from him. And he was incredibly supportive of me, He hated the idea of me playing in a rock and roll band. He didn't like rock and roll. He didn't like the industry. He didn't like the people. He didn't like the flakiness. He didn't like the drugs. He didn't like any of that stuff.
Yeah.
And yet, at the same time, he would always tell me, you have to chase your passion. And in the strategic way that he would always think, he'd say, listen, I'll help you. I'll support you to chase your passion as long as you do the sensible thing and have sort of a backup plan. So the backup plan was kind of college. So I was sort of in and out of college, going to school, playing music, working, kind of bouncing between those three different mediums. And then Dad got sick, and that was a real game changer for me. And right at that time, the band had played its biggest show. And we played for about 1,500 people at the top club called the I-Beam. And it's no longer there, but in San Francisco. And we opened up for a national headlining band. And we got a really good response. We got called out for an encore, which was unusual for those shows. And the venue let us do an encore, which was completely unusual. And our management was like, okay, you're there. You're ready to roll. We can start bringing in... we can start bringing in the labels and go through the whole thing. You're ready. And the next morning, I got a call from the bass player in the band, and he said, I've decided to quit the band. And I was like, what are you talking about? I mean, you were at the show last night, and 1,500 people are going crazy. Like, well, this is it. We're on our way. He said, no, I don't want to do it. I want to write more, and I want to sing, lead vocals, and I want to do, you know, I want to be more of a front man and so forth. And I was like, well, you can write as much as you want, as long as it's stylistically within the genre of the band. And lead vocals, that's not going to happen. You're just not a lead vocalist. And, you know, it just is what it is. I don't care. I don't need to sing lead vocals, but you don't have the voice for it. Mm-hmm. He said, well, that's what I want to do. And I said, okay, how about this? I mean, we've played together for 3 or 4 years. Why don't you play with us for another 3 or 4 months, go through all the showcases that we've got coming up, and then we'll get signed and you'll meet all these people and then you can leave after that. And he didn't want to do it. And I think it scared him. I think he was looking at success really up front and close. And I mean, it took me years to, I couldn't figure it out. I was dumbfounded. But, you know, here we are on this breaking edge, and this guy turns around and walks away. And I think in retrospect, looking back, it was too scary for him. Like, this was now becoming very real. It was a fantasy. And then all of a sudden it's starting to be real. And that was a psychology that he wasn't ready for. And bands are fragile. They have these, you know, they're fragile on the way up, they're fragile on the way down. And that set in motion a whole sequence of things. The 1989 earthquake happened in the same time frame, which cut off our access to the East Bay, which is where our rehearsal studio was. And my dad got sick. And so there were all of these different energies that were pulling at me in different ways. And I was sort of at this point where I had to start looking at myself in the mirror and saying, this might not work. And what are you going to do if you slog along for another 10 years and you're in mostly the same place and you don't break? What do you do with your life at that point? How does that work? What does your resume look like? What are you qualified to do? Like, you can kind of fudge it now, but if you're 36 and not 26, how does that work? And I didn't have an answer. Didn't know how that was going to work.
Were you asking yourself that question? There's a strategic brain of yours that's thinking ahead.
Yeah. Yeah. How am I going to crash land? You know? Yeah. What's my bailout plan? Yeah. And oddly enough, Hourglass may have been my bailout plan. In a way, that's, I've never really thought about it in that way before. But it kind of was. And so Dad passed away.
Sorry.
It was really hard, and it was emotionally very heavy for me. It took me a couple of years to really recover from that. And we were really close. And fortunately, I was able to kind of focus in on mourning that loss rather than, you know, not having a good relationship with him and trying to figure all that weird energy out. So it was helpful in that sense. But I told my mom that I would help her organize the vineyard for her because she didn't know anything about how to deal with that. So I just took that project off her plate. And the next year we got hit with phylloxera. And it's kind of like this double whammy. And so my mom was dead set on selling the family home property that was going to become the Hourglass Estate. It wasn't called that at the time. Mm-hmm. It was just this 6-acre property that mom and dad lived on. It was our home site. And we had planted Zinfandel there. And so he bought it in 76. We planted Zin in 77 and just sold contracted fruit. So I came back to my mom and I said, listen, you can't sell this property. We have to keep it in the family. And she said, well, what would you do with it? And I said, I'd pull out the dying Zinfandel and I'd replant it to Cabernet and I'd start a little label. I had been paying attention to what was going on with the early stages of the cult wine movement. Nobody really refers to it that way anymore, but at that time Screaming Eagle and Harlan and Colgan and Bryant and so forth were just in their early stages, and they weren't household names, but there was a little buzz and so forth, and I thought that was kind of interesting, and they were all kind of chasing Dick Grace's model.
I'm so glad you brought it up, because everyone thinks it started with the Eagle, but it didn't.
No. Screaming Eagle, and actually I would say that of the group, of Bill Harlan was the
He was the earliest.
Other than, I mean, you know, you could make the argument that Al Bornstein might be, you know, the godfather of the cult wine movement with Diamond Creek.
Yeah, his wines are too long term though. I think people just couldn't enjoy them early.
Yeah, and he didn't represent the new style of winemaking. Mm-hmm. But it was Dick Grace that started that off with this postage stamp little teeny vineyard, and he priced the wines in the stratosphere. Who knows what they were at the time, but they were way above the market, and it was mailing list only, and you had to be on the inside to know the right person to get on the list and all this kind of stuff. And so Bill Harlan was watching that, and Jeannie Phillips kind of backed into it in many respects. That's not a diss on Jeannie. She's brilliant. And Screaming Eagle had this really cool thing, but I don't know that she was quite as strategic as Bill Harlan was, or Ann Colgan, or Don Bryant, or some of those early guys. And that was a function of them kind of watching what Dick was doing, taking a few pages from that. The winemaking style was beginning to shift. People were starting to take advantage of the longer growing cycle that we have that Bordeaux does not have, which meant ripeness was beginning to be rethought, and that whole thing was interesting to me. Mm-hmm. And I had played in a rock band with Bob Foley in the mid-80s.
Of course you did.
And Bob had, Bob was up, he had just started at Pride.
Oh, wow.
And maybe second or third vintage, and he'd invited me to come up and barrel taste with him, and I was just absolutely blown away by what he was doing. I'd never tasted wine like this before, and Bob was one of the early transcendent game changers that redirected winemaking in North America, and there were probably another dozen winemakers to pair up with Bob, but I pitched him on this idea of, hey, you know, Mom wants to sell a property. If we replant it to Cabernet, would you help us, you know, with the winemaking on it? And Bob was game. He's like, that's a killer little site. I love your family. My dad and Bob had some dealings, business dealings together. And so he knew the family. Bob's, I think, 9 years older than I am. He knew the family. And so he was in. And then I was able to get a friend of mine who was going through the master's program at UC Davis to get Dr. Cleaver to come down and give us a site evaluation. Because my mom was still really cold on the idea. She's like, Jesus, Jeff, you know how to play guitar and you know, organize a rock band. That has no resemblance to making a, you know, farming and making a wine and distributing it and all of the marketing expertise that goes along with that and so forth. And as it turns out, everything that I ever learned in launching a band, I've used in the wine business. But at the time, it wasn't that correlation. Certainly my mom didn't see that correlation. I really didn't see it either. But I was dead set on this. Like, you can't let this property go.
So. The conclusion of this interview can be found in the next podcast, already available for your download. Thanks again for tuning in to the official podcast of Palate Exposure, featuring Ilona Thompson.